The other thing that I think is, and this is especially for soft medics, get comfortable with malaria.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Landers, founding publisher of the JSOM. I'd like to thank you for joining the JSOM's 20th anniversary interview series. We are excited to bring together a host of experts, all leaders in the soft medical community. In these interviews, we will be discussing the ever-evolving methods of treating battlefield trauma and injury, and how those methods have changed over the 20 years since the JSOM's inception. I hope you'll find these talks as informative as we do.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Josh Randles, one of the hosts of the JSOM podcast. I'll leave Alex to introduce today's interviewee, but there was so much information on this interview, we decided to break it up into two sections. Today, we'll cover the majority of the interview that Alex did with Dr. Maves. But keep an eye on your podcast feed for a little bit of a podcast extra where Dr. Maves goes in depth on antibiotics and the JTS in the deployed setting. Thanks for listening.
And today we've got a very, very special privilege. We are going to chat with Dr. / Captain Ryan Maves. And of course, I'm sure he's tired of hearing the important difference with being a Navy captain versus me, a lowly Army captain.
Not lowly at all.
And sir, I'm sure most everybody knows about your wide-spanning variety for both military medicine as well as soft support. But maybe you could give us a little bit of background about where your involvement has been with that over the last few years.
So thank you very much, first of all. It's just an unexpected pleasure to be invited to talk to you and your colleagues. And I am, like I said, I'm a Navy infectious disease physician and a Navy critical care physician. I divide my clinical time between ID and the ICU. I'm the program director of the Navy's Infectious Disease Fellowship here at Naval Medical Center San Diego. Kind of operationally, I've never had the good fortune or the physical stamina to be directly assigned to a special operations unit. But I was a flight surgeon for Carrier Air Wing 17 on board the George Washington at the onset of OEF. Was involved in kind of the tail end of Operation Southern Watch. After finishing training, I spent time as the staff physician and the director of medical services at the NATO Role 3 Combat Hospital in Kandahar back in 2012. And that was kind of that experience is what led me to go back into training and do a second fellowship in critical care because, you know, involved in taking care of some very, you know, seriously injured and ill people and really was thinking, yeah, I'm a pretty good ID doctor, but I need to be better at the management of, you know, unstable patients. So I went back into training and doing a fellowship, turning 40 during a second fellowship is kind of a humiliating experience. Yeah, I was lucky that, you know, obviously very supportive faculty, both at Navy and at some of our outside affiliated facilities. And obviously a lot of support from guys like Commander Mike Tripp, who is EOD group surgeon, subsequent to this, who is a close friend, residency classmate, and has been very involved in a lot of NSW-related issues over the years. After my critical care training, you know, I've done a lot of, say, kind of consultative and educational work with Naval Special Warfare, all very unofficial. I'm lucky that they're in town, and for whatever reason, they often call me when they need something, and I'm happy to provide whatever advice I can. You know, their medical staff are super smart, and I think most of the time my role is to agree with them. But the but I'll take it. And in more recent years, I've had the chance to go out a few times to work with the ladies and gentlemen out at Ragged Edge in North Carolina for some of the prolonged field care trainings. Mountain Path courses and such as training cadre and his faculty. And that has been a both an inspiring and humbling experience for me because I remember this one time I'm floating in a little dinghy off like a mile off the coast of North Carolina for an exercise. It's me and a gentleman, an anesthesiologist from the UK, out on this exercise getting sprayed down by a H-60 coming in at low altitude. and spending the day traipsing through the woods and driving along with a bunch of SOCOM affiliated folks, and just a ton of fun and a delight to have the opportunity to come along and participate.
So that's why we wanted to talk to you today, is there's lots of other stuff downrange, especially in the austere environment for the soft medic, that is not trauma related. And as a matter of fact, we've just come so far in antibiotic therapy since the JSOM first started publishing. And what I did is I went back to the very inaugural edition of JSOM and found an article in there that I'm sure you've read before, Doctor. And it's from this guy called Frank Butler, who people may have heard of. And the article is titled "Oral Fluoroquinolones, a New Tool for Soft Combat Medics." Today, things are so different. And so I actually went back and also pulled up one of the old soft medic manuals and looked at the reference drug list. And essentially, for those 5 pages, for almost every disease, it was either penicillin or amphotericin, back in the days when that actually killed kidneys. That's where we were 20 years ago. And now I'm looking at the wound care CPGs that I think you were part of. And we're so far from that. And I was hoping you could share how we got there and why we got there and what we're doing for our soft medics today for antibiotic therapy, especially in the austere environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a rapidly evolving topic. So I think what Dr. Butler was writing about then was, you know, either levofloxacin or moxifloxacin. So these are oral fluoroquinolones. You know, one of the advantages of fluoroquinolones is that they're highly bioavailable, meaning that intravenous and oral dosing is essentially the same. And they also get into kind of all the nooks and crannies pretty well. So they'll penetrate into a variety of tissues very well. And that's not true of every antibiotic. Like, for example, aminoglycosides like gentamicin don't get into lung particularly well. They don't get into bone particularly well. And that limits some of their utility for some infections. So quinolones kind of have a dark side too, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, so the idea is we recognize that the risk of infection after combat trauma is very high. We recognize, especially in recent conflicts, it's even higher when you look at the nature of the types of infections you get after blast injury, for example. And there's certainly a generation of military ID physicians and military surgeons and emergency physicians and everyone else who grew up taking care of, you know, young combat casualty patients with IED injuries and very complex, often extremely multi-drug resistant infections. And so the challenge has been, how do we prevent those and to what extent can we prevent those? So, you know, most of the time, you know, when we're in a setting like our recent conflicts where you have uncontested air superiority, after the reforms implemented by Secretary of Defense Gates back in the last decade, you could pretty much get almost anybody to an operating room after combat trauma within an hour. Having that rapid access to definitive surgical care meant that you could keep antibiotic recommendations pretty simple. And so the current guidelines, and these are good guidelines, are basically for almost any kind of penetrating trauma, the answer is cefazolin or ANCEF. We were talking earlier about the use of a certain antibiotic by a certain surgical specialty. If you only know one antibiotic, cefazolin's a pretty good one to know, right? That it's, you know, allergy is almost unheard of. It's rapidly bactericidal. It's a great streptococcal drug. It's a great Staph aureus drug, at least methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus. It will catch a certain amount of gram-negatives like E. coli. Not a lot, but some. It gets into tissue well. I mean, it's very much a workhorse drug, and it became a workhorse drug for a reason. So, you know, most of the time with penetrating combat trauma, the antimicrobial prophylaxis recommendations are 2 grams of cefazolin for a typical adult. If you're going into some space where there's a risk of anaerobic infection, meaning penetrating abdominal trauma, something in the thorax that injures the GI tract, or penetrating brain trauma just because debridement is so difficult, we would add metronidazole or Flagyl, which is an anaerobic antibiotic, to that. And that's all great. That does presuppose that you have access to the real thing that's going to prevent infection, which is going to be surgical washout, debridement of, you know, devitalized tissue, and good wound care, right? So the problem then arises in settings of prolonged field care where you may not have that guaranteed or near guaranteed 1 hour to an operating room. And I think that's where a lot of the challenges of antibiotics in combat trauma come, because where's that dividing line, right? Like, where's the line between our kind of classic TCCC with immediate intervention and life-threatening injuries, you know, tourniquets for life-threatening hemorrhage, needle decompression for pneumothorax, et cetera, where you know you're going to be in an OR pretty fast, and when does that transition into prolonged field care? And I think that's where the gray area comes, and that gray area is relevant to how we use antibiotics in the field. And obviously for the SOCOM community, that's a much more acute need, because that's the sort of situation where your community finds yourselves much more often than my community, where, you know, I find myself wondering if Target is open late enough, right? So it's obviously a different set of perspectives we have to address. The catch with prolonged field care is that we have different antibiotic recommendations. So for a lot of penetrating injuries in prolonged field care, we recommend a different agent, which is called ertapenem, ertapenem, or Invans is the trade name for that. So Invans is also a really great drug, right? I mean, it is very safe. Allergy is essentially unheard of. Just like cefazolin, it is highly bactericidal. It penetrates into tissues very efficiently. It has a very long half-life, meaning for most people, it's once-a-day dosing. So you can give it and you're good till 24 hours. So that's super handy, right? It covers anaerobes, covers gram-negatives. So it's extremely broad spectrum. It's a class of drugs called carbapenems, which are among our most broad spectrum agents. But that's also the Achilles heel that we have to face. And to do that, since this is a 20th anniversary, you have to kind of go back in time a bit. So early on in OIF and OEF, actually specifically OIF, there are these reports of these multi-drug resistant, we call gram-negative bacterial infections in combat trauma. And actually, one of the first observations of this was by Captain Kyle Peterson, retired Captain Kyle Peterson, a Navy ID physician, who was on board the USS Comfort, the USNS Comfort, a hospital ship assigned to support the initial phases of OIF. And Dr. Peterson made this observation of seeing all of these highly drug-resistant combat infections from Acinetobacter, things where we were forced to treat utilizing very old drugs that really hadn't been used very much in decades, like colistin or polymyxin B. These are drugs that were largely used for topical reasons before OIF and OEF. Their toxicities for systemic use were considered unacceptably high. Now it turns out they're not that bad, but that's what we were backed into a corner with. And Kyle was one of the first ones to make these observations, and it became obviously widespread knowledge. And it was a huge problem. It was a huge infection prevention problem. It was a huge problem in preventing transmission of this from one wounded service member to another in a common hospital. There were even a small handful of cases of transmission to healthcare staff. The drugs we had to use were and are potentially quite toxic. And sometimes we'd even occasionally get one that was just basically untreatable. And the only solutions were just repeated surgical debridement. And so with all of that, you know, there's a lot of looks into how can we prevent these sorts of infections. Well, it turns out the answer to that was really just early surgical control, aggressive infection prevention practices in hospitals, and so forth. But one of the strategies explored early on was the early empiric use of broad-spectrum antibiotics, meaning carbapenems often, thinking that if we have an infection that requires treatment of the carbapenem down the road, maybe we could prevent it by giving a carbapenem early on. And it just turns out that that doesn't work, that bacteria are, to be blunt, smarter than us, and they are survivors, and they will rapidly evolve mechanisms of resistance. So if we expose everyone to a carbapenem, basically what we've created is an environment where all infections are resistant to carbapenems. We're just providing evolutionary pressure on the bacteria. And down the road, that leads to enormous difficulties in managing these patients, and ultimately concerns for higher morbidity and higher mortality. So with those observations, drugs like ertapenem, some of its cousins like meropenem or imipenem, were no longer encouraged. They were never really encouraged, but it was a practice that individual clinicians made on their own best judgment, and obviously understandable in difficult time. But the guidelines that currently exist now favoring the use of cefazolin as a narrow-spectrum staph and strep drug for the prevention of combat infections really became the standard. And I'll say that during my time in Kandahar, that was very much the standard. and everyone accepted that as a standard. There were some considerations later on for invasive fungal infections after combat trauma, and there's a lot of discussion about what would be the role for empiric antifungal therapy. But even then, the main guidelines were wound care and surgical debridement to prevent those things from happening. So then moving forward to today, where we have these prolonged field care recommendations for the use of ertapenem, that comes from a variety of considerations. And actually, Colonel Clint Murray, who's currently the command surgeon for U.S. Forces Korea, has written a very nice review in, I believe, the Journal of Wilderness Medicine about considerations for different antibiotics in the prolonged field care environment. And one of the things in Colonel Murray's review, and Colonel Murray is a giant of military ID, there are certain advantages to ertapenem, one of which is very stable for transport. It's very easy to pack in a bag. It's very easy to mix with sterile water in the field. And again, it lasts a very long time. It's got a very long half-life. And it kind of covers everything, and it doesn't have a lot of immediate toxicity to the patient. So there are advantages. So if you have someone who has, again, penetrating abdominal trauma with an enterotomy and they're at risk for developing abdominal sepsis, ertapenem will address most of that. It's not a replacement for surgical intervention, but it definitely will buy you time to get that person to an operating room. Same story for things like severe pneumonias. There's very few settings where I would ever use ertapenem as my first drug in a hospital, right? I mean, it's a drug that has a very narrow empiric usage in a hospital setting, but in the field, and you know it's going to be 24 to 48 hours before someone's coming to pick you up, and you have someone who is seriously injured or septic, then ertapenem's a pretty rational choice. So the problem, and I think the challenge we face as a kind of military medicine community, is figuring out what the ecological consequences of widespread ertapenem use are going to be. Meaning that if we give everyone ertapenem after combat trauma, what does that mean down road when that person has survived their initial injury, their initial life-saving damage control procedures, and then they get back to the States and we are now dealing with the late complications of their injury, bone and joint infections, new wound infections, things like that, that potentially be at risk for being highly drug resistant and thus more difficult to treat because of that early ertapenem. And I think that's unknown. Since prolonged field care is kind of onesies, twosies, right? Relatively low numbers of patients receiving this drug, it doesn't have the same impact on the entire military health system, and it's very easily manageable. But what happens if we do it a lot? And that's kind of the concern. So right now what I'm thinking still is in a place like Afghanistan, where an injured person can get to Kandahar, can get to Bagram pretty quickly in most cases, I think cefazolin is still the answer for that kind of injury. If you have someone operating in AFRICOM or in another remote location where you don't have access to definitive surgical care, then ertapenem makes sense. Or I should say it makes sense today. Whether it's going to make sense in the future, whether we can find something better, I think that's a topic for future research. But I do say when I give talks at Mountain Path or other similar courses, I say, like, you guys are the only people in the world who use empiric ertapenem. I kind of want to keep it that way. Like, I don't want everyone to use these drugs up front because, again, the impact that has. Antibiotics are unique in the sense that they are the one group of drugs where how I treat one patient may affect how I treat the next patient. How if I use one drug too much, I may kind of burn it out, create too much resistance, and I can't use it in the future.
Where you left off was, I thought, such a fascinating point, which is your dedication to focusing ertapenem only to those soft folks who are beyond our doctrinal timelines. And this seems to be one of the big concerns that I've seen is we tend to see such huge indication and treatment creep from the soft community into conventional forces and even over to civilian forces or civilian practitioners. And I'm seeing a huge creep now with T-Tri-C really pushing for some of these carbapenems and that sort of thing. And the rationale is because SOF is doing it. And I was hoping maybe you could expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think this is part of an ongoing conversation, really, with the TCCC folks. You know, we're kind of early in the discussions about what we can do with this. I think those discussions are ongoing. And of course, like a lot of things in the world, got derailed by COVID. And again, I think really the difference is going to have to be how fast are you going to get to an OR or not? Because it's not clear to me that we are helping people down the road if every person gets ertapenem versus every person gets cefazolin. And we actually, one of the challenges here, that sounds like I'm saying, we're going to give the fancy drugs to the special operators, but like Joe Blow, like me, for example, will get just regular old ANSEF. And that is not the intent at all, right? If you have a susceptible infection, you should treat that with ANSEF. You shouldn't treat that with ertapenem. We like to treat serious infections with the narrowest spectrum available drug for that indication. The issue is really who is the optimum person for it. So within DOD, we have this organization called the Infectious Diseases Clinical Research Program, and this is run out of the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda. The director of the program currently is Captain Tim Burgess, a Navy ID physician. We have a study of trauma outcomes called TDOS, the Trauma Infectious Disease Outcome Study. And so TDOS, which has been run by Professor David Tribble out of USIS and out of IDCRP for a number of years now, has studied this and has looked at, okay, do we actually have better outcomes in conventional forces who receive broad-spectrum antibiotics early up front versus receiving a narrow-spectrum agent like cefazolin, assuming you have access to an operating room, early surgical care, early debridement and washout, etc.? And the answer is no, you don't have better outcomes with the broad-spectrum agent, and you probably, down the road, have more issues. But at the same time, cefazolin has limitations. It's relatively shorter half-life. You have to dose it every 8 hours. It is a narrower spectrum drug. If you have penetrating abdominal trauma, it's not sufficient as monotherapy. You have to add something to it. So you need to basically have an infrastructure in place for cefazolin to be an effective drug. In the absence of that infrastructure, you don't have Medivac. You may have more limited access to consultative care. So all of those things together mean that there is going to be a subset of patients in the setting of injury or serious infection for whom upfront ertapenem might be the best decision. And so we just got to figure out who those people are, right? So that we don't trade off some short-term benefits for very significant long-term harms for active duty service folk. And so that's kind of the discussion going on.
And so that seems even bigger picture, which is not that these are ordinally ordered in terms of better or worse, but it's really the right tool for the right job. And so
yeah.
I think in taking a step back, I would be more intrigued to hear from you. How did we arrive at those? What groups of decision-making and committees and working groups have really been in place over the last 20 years and are currently driving some of those practice patterns out there for our soft medics so that they know which tools are the right tools for their right mission in the right environment?
So a lot of this comes out of the joint trauma system. And it's really a lot of it comes from registry data. So it's very difficult and often very ethically fraught to do called kind of gold standard randomized clinical trials in a combat theater. So what we have to do is the most rigorous kinds of retrospective studies. And I say we, I mean we as an institution. The individuals involved have been largely groups working with or affiliated with the joint trauma system. So like the TCCC committee, the emerging prolonged field care committees, who take a lot of the data that has been gathered from the joint trauma registry, and I would say secondarily by studies like TDOS, like the Trauma Infectious Disease Outcome Study, integrating all of that data together to try to give the best possible recommendations. The current guidelines probably had their germinus in a publication by largely a group of Army and Air Force infectious disease physicians, trauma surgeons, and others, which was published in the Journal of Trauma. And I want to say about 2011, a lot of that has been kind of taken on by JTS as part of the clinical practice guidelines. It's a lot of it's the same people involved in the writing of both. And again, my part in that was trivial, and I'm just a working stiff.
And so I think that's just so important for those soft medics out there to foot stomp, that really they end up becoming the tip of the spear, because without well-completed patient care records that go back to the Joint Trauma Service, smart folks like you are not able to then access that registry data, which really drives the change. And I remember looking at some of the articles in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery back around that same timeline when they started talking about those IFIs that you'd mentioned earlier, the invasive fungal infections. And in speaking with some of the folks at the burn center there at the time, and according to the articles, if I remember correctly, those initial patients that were coming back from Afghanistan had almost 100% mortality, which is just completely inappropriate for for us as medical providers, and just heartbreaking for those soldiers and family members. And so it's so great to see that systematic change in practice patterns, but we can't do that without the soft medics, because they really are the starting point for this chain of survival for these soldiers.
Oh, absolutely true. And the invasive fungal infections are a great example. I mean, can you imagine, you know, surviving your initial injury, surviving your initial surgeries, making it all the way home, and then dying of a potentially untreatable infection, right? So invasive fungal infections are a good example of kind of how that process can work. So developing as a community, what approach do you take, and how do you select which patients to try to do interventional measures to prevent this from happening in? And, you know, what came out was selecting patients with a certain degree of injury, a certain amount of devitalized tissue, relying on surgical biopsy results for identifying patients, and then a very strong focus on early aggressive wound care, right? Because the problem is that for a lot of these invasive mold infections, you know, often the drug of choice for that is something called amphotericin B. And, you know, I use ampho routinely in my clinical practice as an ID doctor and as an intensivist, but it's a pretty toxic drug. It has a lot of side effects, a lot of toxicity to the kidneys, and you can imagine someone in hemorrhagic shock with massive blood loss in whom we are empirically giving amphotericin for concern for a future invasive fungal infection. Well, that seems like that's an intervention that could do more harm than good. And so really what JTS did, and this is sort of typical of their process, said, how do we identify people at risk and what is the safest kind of intervention we can make? And that's, I think, kind of a useful thing to think about all these antibiotic recommendations. Some level, yeah, they're recommendations for clinical practice guidelines, but they're also public health interventions, right? So, you know, public health interventions, just like having a reliable water supply, that they are meant to be broadly applicable across a large population, and they need to be pretty easy to implement, right? They can't be overly complicated. And it's not because people aren't smart enough to follow it, but in order to be effective, they need to be clear and straightforward. When we're talking about who's going to get what antibiotic, that needs to be pretty clear cut. And one of the reasons for that is that, like, when I was a medical student, I didn't do a rotation in IED blasts, right? When I was a resident in internal medicine, taking care of people with multiple gunshot wounds was not really part of my training. And in the military, the number of people trained in trauma and or critical care is not that large. I mean, everyone has some training, but the number of people who have specialty training in combat trauma is pretty small. So we need to be able to train everybody to have an acceptable level of proficiency in it, which is why TCCC, which is why ATLS and related courses for nurses, for medics and corpsmen exist, so that there is a common baseline familiarity with taking care of sick and injured people across the entire medical community. When I was in Kandahar, you know, we had two adult critical care physicians, one pediatric critical care physician, a number of general surgeons, but only one of them was specialty trained in trauma and critical care, right? Now, everyone else had done trauma training in their residency, but what everyone did bring to the table was a baseline common level of familiarity through military trauma training and the CPGs, right? Because the CPGs provide you with a framework for managing something that none of us come into deployment medicine totally up to speed on. We have to learn quickly. And the CPGs provide a way so that those lessons can be propagated forward. It's the same thing with the antibiotics, that, you know, me coming into Kandahar as a relatively junior ID doctor in 2012 and having to recreate the wheel, well, that's insane, right? That's insane, because I'm going to make up a bunch of crazy crap and I'm going to throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall and I'm going to see what sticks. Or I could take advantage of the years of systematic data collection by my colleagues, by my seniors, by JTS, by TDOS, and say, okay, we've studied this, we know what the interventions are, let's do that. And then if that doesn't work, then I can come up with something, right?
Well, and I think we're now even struggling more so in that all of those really smart folks you mentioned who had previous combat experience were just such a wealth of knowledge to our seniors. And now with low op tempo, we're actually losing those senior leaders who are able to share their knowledge.
Well,
you know, we always like to end this with a parting thought from somebody. And I was going to ask you about if you were stuck on a desert island, what would be your one antibiotic to take? But I'm guessing your answer is probably be the one you've got.
Yeah, so, yeah, basically.
Instead, what I'd love to ask is, what, looking forward, can you impart wisdom-wise for SofMedics in terms of antibiotics? What is the next big thing coming? What do they need to be on the lookout for? What's the current research?
Yeah, you know, I mean, antibiotics change pretty fast. And, you know, in terms of kind of what the next big thing is, you know, antibiotics are also a little weird that ID doctors tend to hold the new ones kind of close to our chest because we, you know, we obviously want to minimize resistance and things like that. I think what I would say is it's useful to develop a repertoire. I have preferred practice patterns, right? Like I have preferred drugs for preferred situations. My partners may have different drugs for those same situations. My partners are gifted and wise and wonderful human beings and great doctors, and I would entrust my care and that of my family to them. But the way they do things is not necessarily the way I do things and vice versa. So I think it's good to have kind of a personal repertoire of a finite list of agents you use commonly for common situations. And meaning like for soft tissue infections, I use Ceptra or I use doxycycline or I use amoxicillin. I mean, whatever it may be, depending on your circumstance. I'm not specifically advocating any of those three. I'm just lobbing out examples of drugs that could be used for soft tissue infections. For pneumonia, in my presumably young and healthy and immunocompetent population that I care for, I treat with this. And the reason I say that having a finite list of them is useful is because all things have side effects, right? And so knowing not just the pros of a drug are, but the cons are, kind of helps you pick and choose a little bit better, right? Because when I get consulted to see a sick inpatient, you know, obviously, if it was just a question of finding a drug that treated it, well, that comes up in the lab report. You know, my kids could do that. The catch is, what's the downside and what is the best one for this situation? And so having kind of a digestible chunk of antibiotics that you are comfortable with, you're familiar with, you can anticipate the side effects and can make decisions informed by some experience. So I'd say that's one useful thing, is just have kind of a mental list, and it doesn't have to be particularly long. And I said like 5 antibiotics for deployment. The other thing that I think is, and this is especially for SofMedics, get comfortable with malaria, right? Malaria prevention, malaria recognition, and the acute treatment of someone with suspected malaria. Because, you know, the annals of military medical history are littered with cases where we were slow to recognize malaria and bad things happened. And I recognize that taking malaria prophylaxis is a pain and it's not always particularly well tolerated. But, you know, I have taken care of my share of severely ill active duty people coming back from the malaria lands, both in and out of the ICU, and it is the real deal. And I think that getting guys comfortable with that, say like you're in sub-Saharan Africa and you have someone who's rigoring with fever, who has been exposed to a bunch of mosquito bites, or maybe not, but still. You know, we wrestle with, oh, should I treat them empirically for malaria? I'm like, well, how good is your malaria diagnostics? Like, are you in a position where you can definitively rule it in or out? We have the rapid diagnostic tests like the Binax Now cards, and those are good if positive, but their sensitivity isn't perfect. And if you have a high index of suspicion, should you still treat with a negative test? Well, you consider all the times we give people antibiotics empirically based on clinical suspicion. Well, you know, a lot of our drugs for malaria are pretty simple, right? So Coartem, Malarone, these are widespread, easy to use medications. And I think getting comfortable with the recognition and the acute treatment, if you're in a place where you either can't rule it out or you've ruled it in, right? Getting used to that idea, I think, is useful. And I know from a lot of time teaching and talking to folks in your community that concept is out there, but I think it needs to be continuously reinforced. Because just like we said before, the lessons of the past are easy to forget. Talked about people, kind of this cohort of people with combat deployment experience. So first of all, I have like one combat deployment in OEF, right? I mean, I was on an aircraft carrier for the other one. It's a challenging deployment in its own way, but it's not the same as being on the ground, taking care of people who've been shot or blown up. You know, I have friends who have deployed a bajillion times more than me, but we ain't getting any younger. And, you know, I'm an 06, I am closer to the end of my military career than I am to the beginning. But as a 46-year-old man, I am ancient by the standards of a lot of military medicine, right? And we have to find ways to get these lessons propagated to the next generation so that they don't have to learn all of this over again. So a lot of these JTS guidelines are part of that. I think memories about prior malaria outbreaks and things like that, especially for the special operations forces, who are the population at the greatest risk in the operational military, is also very important.
I think what I'm hearing from you is the future of soft austere antibiotic is really the past. It's a theme that we're seeing in these conversations again and again, because really the last 20 years of soft practice has been within these small geographic windows from definitive care with really good supply lines where they can have whatever antibiotics they want. And what I think I'm hearing from you is that if soft components are going out into austere environments like AFRICOM with limited supply lines, they actually may need to be focusing not on the newest whiz-bang drug, but whatever they can procure locally, which may not be a new agent, and they may need to deal with some of those old infections that we haven't really seen much in the last 20 years, but have been an issue for time immemorial for all of humanity before that.
Absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things about ID, and I think COVID is a good example of that, is that, you know, we get new diseases, and this is obviously a time where, you know, a lot of the oxygen in the room in terms of ID is taken up by COVID, appropriately so. But, you know, when this all dies down, we're still going to have malaria, we're still going to have TB, and when folks get injured in combat, they're still going to be at risk of infections, and we got to find the best way to get those back under control. So, yeah, it's turns out human physiology doesn't change that much over time. So I think that's a wise way to put it.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Maves, thank you again so much for your time and insight, and it's just been so wonderful to hear about how your military career has also mirrored some of the dramatic changes in practice, especially in antimicrobial therapy and critical care. I remember not long ago when we would just bleed our phlegmatic patients, and here we are.
Well, you know, that may come back. You know, I you know, we'll see. The good leeching never hurt you.
Everything old is new again, but hopefully we've made a few steps forward, and it certainly couldn't have done it without both your care at the bedside as well as some of your leadership care directing some of these advances in clinical practice.
I'm a tiny part, but thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you. And it's an honor to be asked, and it's absolutely made my week. So thank you so much.
I appreciate your time today. Thanks.
All right, take care.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.